This is Channel One over. This is Channel One over.
I've all got into trouble. Now, are we to believe that all those places were out of touch with some kind of supposed reality? Or is it more reasonable to suppose that entirely new demands, expectations, critical attitudes existing before the fact are now at work speedily and happily destroying the college and the university in this country? I incline to the latter view, because what do you mean by out of touch with? Does that mean failing to satisfy every demand of? Of course, if that is so, nobody can be in touch with anybody else.
But what you're saying, Mr. Barzun, sounds as though you believe there is a conspiracy at work.
No, there is. I don't believe in the conspiracy theory of history. There is simply a convergence of misplaced demands and pressures. Let me take an example completely divorced from the present and from the ugly reality you've referred to. Many years ago, we had a distinguished geologist named Berkey. And he had specialized in the study of shores and tides. And when he became a recognized expert, he began to act as consultants to people who had shorefront property and told them what they ought to do about changing the contour of their beach so that the tides wouldn't take all the sand away. All right. He was putting his scientific knowledge at the service of individuals in his society. Well and good. That was his business, as long as he didn't take so much time away to do that he couldn't teach or do research. But now suppose that there existed a state of affairs in which people who have beaches, or communities that have beaches, large cities that have beaches, expected geologists to do this for them, and expected the physicists to do something else, and the social scientists, and the humanists. Would we have a university, or would we have a group of public consultants at the beck and call of the neighbors, who would then be thoroughly entitled to say, these people are no good, they're not doing what we want, we pay them, and they don't do the work we ask for? That is a little bit the situation in which the university as a whole has got into.
Well, certainly, as you say in the book, universities are now expected to supply expert advice. They're expected to help in
yes.
problems of urban renewal. They're expected to help with problems of welfare.
And to behave in a certain way. For example, one group of parents wants the university to enforce a certain kind of sexual morality. A whole lot of young people, some of them supported by their parents, want a different kind. And the university suddenly becomes not a place of learning, but a battleground for the changing mores. Now, you can't do both. You can't have a battle and quiet study.
No, but perhaps not. But is this perhaps the question? Is the situation that faces this country now so difficult that a university, which is presumed to have gathered together a great deal of knowledge and expertness,
yes.
Is it reasonable to expect the university to help the university, not
yes.
its individual members? Reasonable to expect the university to help the rest of society?
All right.
If the university cannot, who will?
Your second question is so to speak, a cry of despair, not a real question, because if we take the view, which I take, that we really do not know enough collectively, including the university, to solve immediately all the problems that beset us, then it is monstrously unfair to pick upon a particular group of people or a particular institution and say, you aren't doing what you should. I'm all for studying these problems, and they are being studied, but results are very slow. Moreover, how do we know that there are problems in the ordinary mathematical sense, namely, that they have a solution? A little glance at history shows that many problems of the past had no solution. They either disappeared or they landed nations in conflict and blood and disaster, after which there was no problem.
Get rid of a problem, not solve it. What you're really saying, Mr. Barzan, is that if there is a problem to be dealt with, whether it is soluble or not, it is a great mistake for any university to place its emblem or its insignia on a proposed solution to it.
Unless there's absolute certainty that, or near certainty that the solution has been tested, is valid, or anything of that sort. But we don't even get that in medicine, do we? No. Every medical cure is statistical in effect and hypothetical to the very last day.
So your criticism of the university is radically different from the most common criticism of the university, which is that the university is excessively resistant to change. You say it is not sufficiently resistant to change.
It has changed so rapidly in the last 25 years that it is now in a mess. Now, there's one other possible view of the whole thing, that since the world is in a very bad way, it's only fair that the university should be in a bad way, too. But that's a little bit the mixture of scapegoat and companionship in misery. And there, I would say it's perhaps a human trait, but not one to be made into a principle.
Now, could we particularize this a bit? One of the criticisms that some Columbia University students made, I emphasize
yes.
the word some, had to do with the university's association with the government in defense matters.
Yes.
And although the students may have been quite wrong about what the university was doing, in any case, they objected to that association. What should be the relations, if any, between universities and government?
I think that's a very good example of this whole issue we're trying to thrash out here. As many students, I suppose, favored government research grants and contracts as opposed it. So what does the university do? It should have absolutely no position on that and leave it to the individual scientist or scholar whether he, as an individual, will accept government support for his work. The one thing that the university can do and did do, and Columbia never deviated from it, was to make absolutely sure that the research so undertaken is pure research, not mechanical work of application or production, and that it has a component element valuable in teaching. In other words, graduate students, by helping the senior professor in the pursuit of his contract work, learn physics or mathematics or whatever it is. Now, having maintained the educational principle, the university has nothing more to say. And it seems to me the students have nothing more to say unless they themselves declare illegal and unconstitutional something that is perfectly allowed by the laws of the country. Man can be invited to do research and he says yes or no.
But a university, in your view, should have no contract between the university and any agency of government.
You're going through a kind of technicality. The government prefers to make contracts through a central authority, which is that of the university, but involving a particular man, and it's the man who goes to Washington and reports. He signs the scientific papers. He is responsible from beginning to end. The contract is with the university, and it sits in a box in an office for contract research. Maybe that technicality could be removed if necessary. But it isn't what the students object to. They don't object to the technicality or the machinery. They object to Mr. So-and-so doing something that they believe wrong because they think that ultimately that research, though pure, will come out in the defense of the country. One might ask them, what is wrong with the defense of the country? But they're not inclined to answer that. They merely look at contemporary events and judge them from a moral point of view.
Well, I think all of us became caught up in the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
To
that aggravated many, many issues. But I think that the real one, the genuine student grievance, which they don't articulate very often, is that they're poorly taught and less taught. And if they'd made an outcry on that score, I would have mounted the barricades with them.
Well, you feel that universities have gone in much too much for research.
Yes.
You say there has been a flight from teaching.
Yes. I don't say that. I think the phrase is John Gardner's, but I espouse it.
Yes, you accepted it in the book, certainly.
Yes, I do.
What do you mean by that, a flight from teaching? You mean, I suppose, that it's got to the point now where some faculty members are wooed to the faculty by being promised that they won't have to teach at all.
Yes, and incidentally, it's something that Columbia University has never done. There are no research professorships, except for a one-year leave, providing just for that. Everybody has to teach, but there can be a flight from teaching without loss of teaching assignments. It's a matter of attitude, atmosphere, availability for conferences with students, the amount of visible preoccupation that the man has with other things while the student talks to him. It's emotional, profound, and in its results, unhappily tangible. Students are not as well taught as they once were. There are other elements, not just the consulting work that do that, as I try to explain. The casual style that was brought in about 30 years ago as a result of progressive education has damaged teaching. The lecture method went to pieces. The discussion group is hardly led, and there is a sense in which an enormous amount of talking and meeting goes on with no results, and the students feel that.
Yes, I wrote down somewhere, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't find it at the moment, a phrase of yours. I think it was it a mania for informality?
Yes.
Have I got that
something
right?
Something like that, yes.
My notes are so informal I couldn't find it. But what it amounts to then is that universities and university professors, university administrators are left without authority. They don't enjoy the respect of their students, you think, because of the breakdown in informal relationships between them. That has simply been destroyed. There is an idea somehow that teachers and students are equals.
Yes, and of course that always was a goal, but not an assumption. There was nothing more productive of good, sound educational results, it seems to me, than the gradual admission of a student to the unspoken status where he was considered a full-fledged mind and could talk freely with his instructor. That was the great superiority of the American system over the continental, for example. But now, where there is nothing to earn and no meaning to the informality, it is at best an excuse for avoiding responsibility.
Well, I have found the phrase, the maniacal insistence of the entire culture on informality at
yes.
all times.
Yes.
Informality being capitalized. When you have contact with students, Mr. Barzan, how do they address you? Do they call you prof? Do they?
No, they call me Mr., as is the custom on Eastern campuses, or they call me nothing at all, come in and ask a question. They're extremely polite and also lively and say what they think. And we generally get on terms of pleasant conversational simplicity quite soon. I don't talk to them in officialese. They don't ask me questions to show off. And that is the teaching situation outside the classroom hour. In a certain sense, it cannot be provided for. It cannot be engineered by any rules, whether the rules of the institution or the rules of the society around it. It has to be spontaneous and genuine. And maybe genuine is the word that we ought to try to hang on to in all these complex situations and contacts of human beings in a university and outside.
But when you're talking about the relations between the teacher and student, you have written that not merely has there been a flight from teaching, John Gardner's phrase. You say teachers may feel that students are leeches after their life's blood.
Yes.
Which amounts to saying that teachers don't want to teach.
Well, that's right, because you see the prestige goes to everything but teaching. Good teacher is a term of dispraise, or it's damning with faint praise. The thing to do, to be famous, to be sought after, to lead a traveling existence between great centers of learning or of government, is to be known as a tremendous researcher. And to do that by either doing research and publishing things yourself or organizing a team to do it for you. I'm not implying any overt dishonesty there.
Well, is this so far out of hand that there's really nothing more to be done about it? I mean,
I don't know. I wouldn't want to judge. I think that a good many people are having a certain amount of heart-searching these days, I mean faculty members, and asking themselves whether they've done right or wrong. Moreover, there are plenty of people who have continued to pursue, in spite of all temptations, the old traditional duties of the scholar and teacher. And I imagine that some people are going to interpret, as I do, the student dissatisfaction as a sign that the relationship of the teacher to the student has somehow been distorted, corrupted.
There's one thing I suppose at this point I think I might be well to get clear, and that is your view of research for a university generally. You think that has gone very much too far and not merely has corrupted the university, but has involved the university in financial burdens that far outweigh the assistance it may get from government or foundations or corporations that ask for the research to be done.
Yes. The university is never fully reimbursed for anything it does, whether it's research, teaching, or public service, so-called. But even that wouldn't matter. It would be easy to appeal to the public on the basis of that need if the whole operation hadn't become in some ways very questionable. For example, what can anybody expect from what amounts to enforced research? You cannot get promoted. You cannot get the advantages and perquisites of high office within the academic world unless you turn out this, that, and the other thing, unless you're issuing papers like confetti on a parade. It's created the I think, imaginary impression that there's a knowledge explosion. There's a paper and print explosion. I wonder what posterity will say of all this, and how much is going to be deemed real knowledge or new knowledge. I see a great many things, and I have the confidences of people in various fields of science and scholarship to confirm my impression that a good deal is repetitious, not true, and was known before. It's a knowledge inflation.
Well, it has been called an information explosion, and it's thought to be particularly large in science.
Yes.
But
there are critics of that in science itself.
You are, of course, Mr. Barzan, referring here to two things. You're referring to the so-called information or knowledge explosion, and you're also referring to the publish or perish approach.
Yes.
To promotion for members of the faculty.
Yes. The two are connected.
The idea being that if anybody wants to establish his position or prestige in his field, he must be able,
yes,
to point to something he has written and,
yes,
had published.
Yes.
And you think that also is bad? Is,
I think so. If he had to produce something that he had written and published, and then also produce somebody who'd read it and believed it, I think we would have a healthier state of affairs.
So you think that, not merely as a public being fooled, you think that there's a very large confidence game going on within the educational establishment?
With this difference, of course, that confidence games are conscious, and this is all unconscious. This is all the lemming effect of, or the bandwagon effect.
Well, perhaps it's not all unconscious. I remember one or two examples from your book, The American University, in which you tell of a junior instructor who published the same thing in four different forms, or perhaps only changed the title.
Yes.
Of it.
The gradations are slight from what is legitimate to do under certain circumstances to what becomes a trick. And there are operators, but of course there are under any system. Only I'd rather have the operator old style, who didn't clutter up the shelves with a lot of unwanted matter, but on the contrary, operated to lead a perfectly easy, idle life. He's less of a danger than this dynamo that we have now brought into being. Well, if research is supposed to be the result of unusual talent, then it should be freely given. The individual is not a machine that should turn out things. He is a talent or a mind or a genius, whatever you want to call him, who, in his own good time, produces what he thinks is important and true.
Well, may we move on from this to a related subject. I very nearly used the word relevant, but I hesitated to do so because one of the things you are most disturbed by is the insistence of some students that their courses be relevant, which is to say,
yes,
relevant to the world as it is today and relevant to the problems that press upon the country and press upon,
yes,
the city. And you believe that that is something that is simply unattainable, or if it is attainable, it's not worth attaining, that it's a chimera, really, that it simply can't be had with education to retain any value.
Yes, it's a misunderstanding, as I think, of the difference between information and knowledge, which you yourself drew a moment ago. Information is very useful for the thing that you want to do immediately, and there are things in the papers every day that thoughtful and conscientious citizens should be concerned about. But the years of education, particularly in college, are neither for piling up information nor for its immediate use in topical contexts. It is to create a different kind of human being out of the boy of 17 or 18, the girl of 17 or 18, so that after graduation, or after graduation plus some special training, that person is somehow enhanced in his powers to deal with any situation that concerns him. And then he can turn to the information and apply it. If he doesn't want to wait, if he thinks the emergency is so great, then he ought to get out into the world, help to clean it up, reform it, whatever he wants, then return for an education. But education is a dealing with an organism. It is not mechanical operation through an organism.
You make a distinction between study and qualifying. You say that the original intention of the university was to encourage study, but that people now use it to qualify for particular jobs.
Yes. The notion that the university can provide courses that fit you for this or that post is a notion that has grown up with the great enlargement of our system, the fact that very few people do anything now directly dealing with men or materials, but work through paper and symbols and wires and computers. And the result is a kind of Mandarin system, as I call it, in which you have to pick up the various certificates, the various recommendations, and the various grades that will impress somebody else who cannot make a judgment about you, because he's also dealing at remote control with his future employees or the candidates for the job. So in this sort of shadow boxing, the student loses all sense of what study is. He doesn't think really of himself as having a mind and a self. He is a collection of attributes. He qualifies. He says, I've got it. I've done it. I've had it. And in a certain sense, he has had it.
Well, inevitably, Mr. Barzan, this leads to this leads me to ask you for specific examples. What is now being taught? What is now being offered in universities that should not be? What should be eliminated? And what are some of these so-called relevant subjects that students ask for that they should not be provided with?
That puts the question a little differently from the facts as I see them. They want the relevant subjects. They pick up the specifications, as I say, from the daily paper. For example, at one law school, there was a complaint from the students that military law was not taught, and we were in a state of war. It was very important to know that. So far, these are demands that have been yielded to here, there, or the other place, more or less ad hoc. What is wrong with the rest is not what is offered, but the way it is taught and taken. You accumulate a major in something in order to become presumably a professional in that line. The teaching, therefore, becomes training and not teaching. And I've had it from some of my colleagues in so many words. They're quite proud of it, that they go and teach sophomores anthropology looking for those who will make good anthropologists. Well, if anthropology is offered as an elective to, let's say, satisfy the social science requirement, it's perfectly obvious that a class of 50 or 60 sophomores are not all going to become anthropologists. And if they are taught the techniques of anthropology, right away, they will lose interest. They will simply grind through the course in order to check off that requirement. They've had it. And nobody can ask them to have it again. And what it leaves, I don't know, but it certainly doesn't leave an idea of what anthropology means for the world of the mind at large, how it has shaped the whole attitude of this century to itself. I mean, all sorts of things that are very important to have, as well as the facts of some particular anthropological theory. In all these things, there is the, I think, very dangerous feeling that there isn't time, that the crisis is upon us. That is destructive of all that we mean by education. Now, you may say, but we have no time, and the crisis is upon us. Then I say, let's suspend education. Let's have a moratorium and take it up again when we can afford the time.
Let's take another example. I know that some law schools are now offering courses of study, I don't know whether for credit, in what is called poverty law, because the question of the number of poor people in this country has become pressing within the last 8 or 10 years. Now, is that, now, I don't know, maybe a law school is a trade school in a sense. It's to qualify, perhaps, rather than study. But is that a, that's relevant. Now, should it be offered?
Certainly, provided that there is in the first instance a thorough grounding in the principles of the law, quite apart from this kind of law, labor law, poverty law, corporation law, which come on top of some educational idea about the law as a whole. And that is taught naturally through particular types of law, but they are central as these are special. That's always happened in all subject matters, and there are, for example, basic sciences to all of medicine. But then you wind up in cardiology or surgery. Now, you don't just begin with those and end with those.
Well, I suppose, Mr. Marzan, we're treading on a larger subject, which is, should certain things be part of a university at all? Should a university include a school of business administration? Columbia, your own university, has a very well-known school of journalism.
Yes.
I think it's called College of Journalism now, to which I perhaps should explain I didn't go. I have no connection with it. Should it have a school of journalism? Should a university have that?
I would make the answer general, if you would allow me. I would say that any university can include a school dealing with any subject that has been reduced to theory and can be taught as principles. The application or the practical side being indicated at the very end of the course. And one interesting thing that the public and the students ignore or have never been sufficiently told is that most of the people who are carrying on the world's work do not want the graduate or the certificate holder to come with a ready-made set of practical gimmicks, believing that they will be helpful to him. Again and again, we have heads of industries and government bureaus and so on saying, bring us well-educated and quick and true-thinking people, and we will, in 3 weeks, tell them the current tricks and devices, because those change very rapidly. And it is not a really practical method to make people too practical too soon.
Now, this is, what you're saying, Mr. Barzan, seems to me to be something like the system that is employed in the British Civil Service, which doesn't require the same kind of specialization that our own civil mm-hmm. service does upon entry, and so it takes in a great many what we would call classics graduates.
Yes.
On the other hand, the British appear to be moving away from that system and somewhat in the direction of our own.
Yes.
As indeed I think European universities are moving somewhat in our own direction.
There we're talking about a vast cultural movement which is so far rather difficult to assess.
Except for
understand.
Journalists.
Two things are possible. One, that the demand for larger and larger numbers of people in every profession you can name means that you have to dig down deeper into the pool of talent, and you reach persons who have very little talent of any kind, and they have to be given what might be called a sort of artificial talent, a set of memorizable things which do not come out of their own minds. And if I may say so, we've seen that in this country in teacher training. We had to take, because we needed so many teachers, people who had absolutely no gift for it whatsoever. So we taught them a whole lot of things, and I think the unhappy state of public education is a result of doing just that. Now, we may be doing the same thing in other fields, engineering, business administration, whatnot. And that's a deplorable state, because there comes a time when people generally wake up and say, we haven't got the people we thought we had, even though they're fully certified. In other words, there hasn't been any substitute found for brains. And when the educational system does not strengthen and develop all the brains that nature gives us, we're in a bad way.
What you're saying, Mr. Barzan, if I understand it correctly, is that the standards of measurement have really been abandoned, and that we're kidding ourselves about what we're actually getting.
A lot of the time. The standard of judgment, I would say. We have substituted measurement, which is very unreliable because it is pseudo-measurement.
May I return to something you said before, because I think it requires some explanation, and that is how universities lose money when it seems that they're actually getting money.
Getting it.
And that's hard to understand, because you pick up your paper and you read that such and
yes.
such a university has been given $897 million for a cyclotron, or somebody
yes.
has given the City University of New York $100,000 for a particular professorship.
Yes.
And you say, why isn't the $100,000... I would say, why isn't the $100,000 enough? It sounds like a great deal of money to me.
It is indeed, and it is a very exceptional amount for a professorship. Let's begin with your first question. All government money for grants for scientific research, and research in social science too, requires by law what is called cost sharing. The university must contribute something and must demonstrate that it does so. It may not be a very large amount for the government, but it's a great deal for the university. Say 5% of the cost of any contract must be provided somehow by the university. On top of that, there is the inevitable, usual, I won't say fight, but difference of opinion between the government auditors and the university as to allowable overhead costs. And usually the university feels that those are not fully reimbursed, even though the government tries to be very fair. Grants that come from private foundations never carry overhead, often entail the continuance of the project beyond the time of the grant itself. It expires and you have to carry it. Teaching, as you know, is subsidized perhaps 40% by the student fees. So that I am saying something that is not in dispute and which has been printed a number of times by competent people, that the university loses on all that it furnishes. Now, there are windfalls, gifts with no strings attached, things of that sort, which go toward the endowment. But the endowment is being spread so thin over cost sharing, over the overhead for supporting foundation grants, over teaching, that something's got to give. Now, to take your unusual case of the $100,000 professorships that the state of New York has established in honor of Einstein and Schweitzer, that is the type of the restricted gift. It can go to only one person, his assistants, and his research. It doesn't do the rest of the institution any good. And I think there would be a great deal of complaint from the state government if the university that had it said, well, we want to charge 5% of that just for administering it.
In other words, the more money you get, the more likely you are to go bankrupt.
Oh, you are. Absolutely. It's not a paradox, and it was visible even 25 years ago. I think that in the book on universities that I published at that time called Teacher in America, I mentioned that phenomenon and said that many colleges were getting grant poor.
What about conferences, Mr. Barzan? I know that you have a particular, shall I call it, phobia about conferences, which you elaborate on in the book, The House of Intellect. They're a great time waster, I think, aren't they?
I think they are.
The symposium are. And the conference.
You see, there's one thing I ought to say, perhaps in self-explanation, not to say self-defense. I seem to be sweeping with a lackluster eye everything that goes on and saying it's all no good. That is not my attitude at all. I have no vow registered in heaven to dislike whatever I encounter.
I would be very sorry if I had led to that impression getting around, because I know from the book it's not true.
But the conference has a perfectly good reason to exist. People who are working on different aspects of something want to get together and discuss it, and more light and more knowledge will come out of it. That is what led to the great international congresses of scholars and scientists that were the glory of the 19th century. But we have to observe what happens when something gets institutionalized, and when everybody has to be at or hold a conference every week about something somewhere. It becomes a cakewalk, and everybody's either coming from one or going to it. The readjustment is a loss of energy and time. And as my friend Dr. René Dubos has once said, all the conference speeches have already been given. You can only go to another and give the same speech. Not really the same, you know,
it's presumptuous of me, but I think it's true. I do that myself. But there are conferences in this field as well.
Yes, and, I'm sure.
And we tend to tell each other things we already know. Well, having disposed of the conference and the symposium, however gently, you don't have an awful lot of time left, and I would like to ask you, Mr. Barzan, about the students. You have found that the protest generally is rather incoherent and pointless. At least it seems to you to be pointless. But the students demand a part in making policy,
yes,
that kind of thing. Now, is there any justification for that? Does it make any sense at all that they should?
I think students have long had an influence on policy, though they don't recognize it. Because it's perfectly obvious that they have never been prevented from talking to their advisors, their favorite instructor, their deans and deans of students, and what they say is not just forgotten. It influences judgments of programs, courses, those who teach those courses. Now, what they want is to formalize that. And I'm afraid that they're going to have less influence than they had before, because all their effort will now go into working the formal machinery. There's a false impression that has grown up as a result of the recent troubles, and that is that all students think alike. They don't. So they're going to have to organize in parties. I was talking with a group of my own students and some of their friends whom they brought in, who are not students of mine, including some freshmen, which I was very glad to do. And after discussing the pros and cons with no animosity whatsoever for about an hour and a half, a couple of the students came to the conclusion that they couldn't possibly get any other student to represent them. They said, "We want to represent ourselves, our own views." So I said, well, the only way to do that is to express those views to those who are in charge of the curriculum, in charge of promoting young instructors, because any machinery will call for representation. After all, you can't have all the students shouting contradictory advice. Not to mention the fact that there's more behind the scenes. There's a part of the iceberg below the waterline that students know nothing about. And they often think that what they encounter is done carelessly or heedlessly or without thought of them. And the fact is that things are done that way because there's no other way to do them.
Well, should students have anything to do with rating professors, teachers?
They've always done that too, you know, fitfully, but always with complete freedom. Publish an issue of the paper or a separate booklet in which courses are rated. And during the last 12 or 15 years, many institutions have had the private rating. Students fill out a form, and those forms are sent to the instructor. I don't much like that device. It seems a little bit an anonymous letter. But let them rate anything in the world. That's fine. Let them petition their department for a course in this and dropping the course in that. They're not held back from that.
No, it seems
you don't have to break windows in order to write out a petition. You really don't.
It seems that what they want to do is go beyond the petition, and that is to say, if they do present a petition, they want to be assured that it's going to be accepted. There, of course, they run into the difficulty, as you say, that student body is made up of a great many students and a great variety
divergent
of opinions.
That's right. And some of them have wanted to have student representation on the Board of Trustees. Well, which student or students are going to be able to speak, in the first place, knowledgeably to the trustees, and in the second place, with the confidence that they represent a whole miscellaneous student body? It's not workable.
Mr. Barzan, your own university went through a good deal of travail, one consequence of which was the premature retirement from the presidency of Grayson Kirk, who ceased to be president a little sooner than he otherwise would have.
A few months. He had
and certainly was put through a very difficult time.
Yes.
And that seems to me to be, whatever else it may be, clear evidence that something was wrong somewhere. Did this come about because students were particularly evil, or because there was some kind of plot afoot, or is why have we had this widespread unrest? Is it follow the leader? How to account for it? Why do things seem to be so serious in that respect?
Well, it is known that all over the world there are groups of students, whether they're united or not, I don't know, who are openly revolutionists, and they want to overthrow the existing society, beginning with the university, because that's where they are, and that's the place they know best how to subvert. Here or there or the other place, they have managed to enlist the aid of non-revolutionary students who had grievances of their own. And the lesser grievance has been, as it were, activated or energized by the more radical grievance of wanting to get rid of present-day society. Thirdly, in this country, and to a certain extent in Paris and in Rome, the use of police force to restore a semblance of order has outraged still another group, who probably have not wondered how order is maintained, or who have believed that the right words would have done the thing. I don't know. But anyway, in all these places, the upset has been the result of a collection of different, distinct, and temporary alliances.
Which happen to coincide with a particular set of social and economic circumstances.
Yes, there are some very vivid, dramatic, violence-arousing things going on in the world today that you can make the university responsible for.
Mr. Barzan, we have about 3 minutes left, which is not very much time to give you to set out, if you would, some of your suggestions for what a university ought to be and what changes ought to be made. I would just lead into that by asking you whether you have perhaps what Arthur Kessler once referred to as a nostalgia for the lost cause, whether you're not hoping to go back to something in the way of a university that can never again be.
Oh, I shouldn't say that. I have no nostalgia. I don't like lost causes. I don't think that things are lost forever. The greatest universities in the world have gone through periods of eclipse and come back to what is, after all, a central idea of the university, to teach and to learn. If that is the goal of an institution, call it whatever you like, you can call it the academy like Plato, certain relationships derive from that, which are inherent in the nature of things. They're not the decision of anybody in particular. Teacher, student, unknown universe. You explore the unknown universe, you tell the student what you know, and he asks questions. He makes you responsible for the shaping of his mind, and you feel responsible for transmitting the culture, the knowledge of your own time and place. That's fundamental. That's all I want. Now, you have trimmings of one kind or another. You have architecture of one kind or another. Those are inessential. And since you give me the opening, I want to say that my book is not about contemporary troubles, except as showing where, buried in the rubble, there are wonderful universities still doing good work. And I try to point out where it is and how it is either supported or subverted.
Well, I would be very sorry if I gave the impression that this book of yours, The American University, were a long cry of anguish and criticism, because there's...
I don't weep, do I?
This is... No, you don't. There's infinitely more to it than that, and obviously what you want to do is bring the university back to what you think it should be. And I hope I've given you a sufficient opportunity to set that out.
Oh, indeed. I wasn't making a complaint.
Thank you, Mr. Barzun. Jacques Barzun has been speaking freely. This is Edwin Newman, NBC News.
And that is certainly clear enough to use. That's clear enough to use. That certainly is clear enough to use. I'm taking it down this Sunday afternoon, the 10th of August, 69, after I had taken in the gospel sing Saturday night and the dinner on the ground today, Sunday, at Louise Graham's. And this is Channel 1 Over. This is Channel 1 Over, now around 690. Now around 690, Channel 1 Over. Jacques Barzun on the university.